Section 7. The Struggle for a Normal Working Day. Reaction of the English Factory Acts on Other Countries. The reader will bear in mind that the production of surplus value, or the extraction of surplus labour, is the specific end and aim, the sum and substance, of capitalist production, quite apart from any changes in the mode of production, which may arise from the subordination of labour to capital. He will remember that as far as we have at present gone, only the independent labourer, and therefore only the labourer legally qualified to act for himself, enters as a vendor of a commodity into a contract with the capitalist. If, therefore, in our historical sketch, on the one hand, modern industry, on the other, the labour of those who are physically and legally miners, play important parts, the former was to us only a special department, and the latter only a specially striking example of labour exploitation. Without, however, anticipating the subsequent development of our inquiry, from the mere connection of the historic facts before us, it follows, first, the passion of capital for an unlimited and reckless extension of the working day is first gratified in the industries earliest revolutionized by water power, steam, and machinery, in those first creations of the modern mode of production, cotton, wool, flax, and silk spinning and weaving. The changes in the material mode of production, and the corresponding changes in the social relations of the producers, gave rise first to an extravagance beyond all bounds, and then, in opposition to this, called forth a control on the part of society which legally limits, regulates, and makes uniform the working day and its pauses. This control appears, therefore, during the first half of the 19th century, simply as exceptional legislation. Footnote. The employments placed under restriction were connected with the manufacture of textile fabrics by the aid of steam or water power. There were two conditions to which an employment must be subject to cause it to be inspected, viz. The use of steam or water power, and the manufacture of certain specified fibre. End of footnote. As soon as this primitive dominion of the new mode of production was conquered, it was found that in the meantime not only had many other branches of production been made to adopt the same factory system, but that manufactures with more or less obsolete methods, such as potteries, glass-making, etc., that old-fashioned handicrafts like baking, and finally even that the so-called domestic industries, such as nail-making, had long since fallen as completely under capitalist exploitation as the factories themselves. Footnote. On the condition of so-called domestic industries, specially valuable materials are to be found in the latest reports of the Children's Employment Commission. End of footnote. Legislation was, therefore, compelled to gradually get rid of its exceptional character, or, where, as in England, it proceeds after the manner of the Roman casuists, to declare any house in which work was done to be a factory. Footnote. The Acts of last session, 1864, embrace a diversity of occupations, the customs in which differ greatly, and the use of mechanical power to give motion to machinery is no longer one of the elements necessary, as formerly, to constitute, in legal phrase, a factory. End of footnote. Second, the history of the regulation of the working day in certain branches of production, and the struggle still going on in others in regard to this regulation, prove conclusively that the isolated labourer, the labourer as free vendor of his labour power, when capitalist production has once attained a certain stage, succumbs without any power of resistance. The creation of a normal working day is, therefore, the product of a protracted civil war, more or less dissembled, between the capitalist class and the working class. As the contest takes place in the arena of modern industry, it first breaks out in the home of that industry. England. Footnote. Belgium, the paradise of continental liberalism, shows no trace of this movement. Even in the coal and metal mines, labourers of both sexes and all ages are consumed in perfect freedom at any period and through any length of time. Of every 1,000 persons employed there, 733 are men, 88 women, 135 boys, and 44 girls under 16. In the blast furnaces, etc., of every 1,000, 668 are men, 149 women, 98 boys, and 85 girls under 16. Add to this the low wages for the enormous exploitation of mature and immature labour power. The average daily pay for a man is 2 shillings and 8 pence. For a woman, 1 shilling and 8 pence. For a boy, 1 shilling and 2 pence halfpenny. As a result, Belgium had, in 1863, as compared with 1850, nearly doubled both the amount and value of its exports of coal, iron, etc. End of footnote. The English factory workers were the champions not only of the English, but of the modern working class generally, as their theorists were the first to throw down the gauntlet to the theory of capital. Footnote. Robert Owen, soon after 1810, not only maintained the necessity of a limitation of the working day in theory, but actually introduced the 10 hours day into his factory at New Lanark. This was laughed at as a communist utopia. So were his combination of children's education with productive labour and the cooperative societies of working men, first called into being by him. Today, the first utopia is a factory act. The second figures as an official phrase in all factory acts. The third is already being used as a cloak for reactionary humbug. End of footnote. Hence, the philosopher of the factory, Ure, denounces as an ineffable disgrace to the English working class that they inscribed the slavery of the factory acts on the banner which they bore against capital, manfully striving for perfect freedom of labour. Footnote. Ure, French translation, Philosophie des Manufactures, Paris, 1836, end of footnote. France limps slowly behind England. The February Revolution was necessary to bring into the world the 12 hours law, which is much more deficient than its English original. Footnote. In the Compte Rendu of the International Statistical Congress at Paris, 1855, it is stated, "The French law, which limits the length of daily labour in factories and workshops to 12 hours, does not confine this work to definite fixed hours. For children's labour only, the work time is prescribed as between 5 a.m. and 9 p.m. Therefore, some of the masters use the right which this fatal silence gives them to keep their works going without intermission day in, day out, possibly with the exception of Sunday. For this purpose they use 2 different sets of workers, of whom neither is in the workshop more than 12 hours at a time, but the work of the establishment lasts day and night. The law is satisfied, but is humanity? Besides the destructive influence of night labour on the human organism, stress is also laid upon the fatal influence of the association of the 2 sexes by night in the same badly lighted workshops." End of footnote. For all that, the French revolutionary method has its special advantages. It once for all commands the same limit to the working day in all shops and factories without distinction, whilst English legislation reluctantly yields to the pressure of circumstances, now on this point, now on that, and is getting lost in a hopelessly bewildering tangle of contradictory enactments. Footnote. For instance, there is within my district one occupier who, within the same curtilage, is at the same time a bleacher and dyer under the Bleaching and Dyeing Works Act, a printer under the Print Works Act, and a finisher under the Factory Act. Report of Mr. Baker in Reports for October 31, 1861. After enumerating the different provisions of these acts and the complications arising from them, Mr. Baker says, "It will hence appear that it must be very difficult to secure the execution of these three Acts of Parliament where the occupier chooses to evade the law. But what is assured to the lawyers by this is lawsuits." End of footnote. On the other hand, the French law proclaims as a principle that which in England was only won in the name of children, minors, and women, and has been only recently, for the first time, claimed as a general right. Footnote. Thus, the factory inspectors at last venture to say, "These objections, of capital to the legal limitations of the working day, must succumb before the broad principle of the rights of labour. There is a time when the master's right in his workman's labour ceases, and his time becomes his own, even if there were no exhaustion in the question." End of footnote. In the United States of North America, every independent movement of the workers was paralyzed, so long as slavery disfigured a part of the republic. Labor cannot emancipate itself in the white skin, where in the black it is branded. But out of the death of slavery a new life at once arose. The first fruit of the Civil War was the 8 hours' agitation that ran with the seven-leagued boots of the locomotive from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from New England to California. The General Congress of Labor at Baltimore, August 16, 1866, declared, "The first and great necessity of the present, to free the labor of this country from capitalistic slavery, is the passing of a law by which 8 hours shall be the normal working day in all states of the American Union. We are resolved to put forth all our strength until this glorious result is attained." Footnote. "We, the workers of Dunkirk, declare that the length of time of labor required under the present system is too great, and that, far from leaving the worker time for rest and education, it plunges him into a condition of servitude but little better than slavery. That is why we decide that 8 hours are enough for a working day, and ought to be legally recognized as enough. Why we call to our help that powerful lever, the press, and why we shall consider all those that refuse us this help as enemies of the reform of labor and of the rights of the laborer." Resolution of the Working Men of Dunkirk, New York State, 1866. End of footnote. At the same time, the Congress of the International Working Men's Association at Geneva, on the proposition of the London General Council, resolved that the limitation of the working day is a preliminary condition, without which all further attempts at improvement and emancipation must prove abortive. The Congress proposes 8 hours as the legal limit of the working day. Thus the movement of the working class on both sides of the Atlantic, that had grown instinctively out of the conditions of production themselves, endorsed the words of the English factory inspector R. J. Saunders. "Further steps towards a reformation of society can never be carried out with any hope of success unless the hours of labour be limited, and the prescribed limit strictly enforced." It must be acknowledged that our labourer comes out of the process of production other than he entered. In the market, he stood as owner of the commodity labour-power, face to face with other owners of commodities, dealer against dealer. The contract by which he sold to the capitalist his labour power proved, so to say, in black and white, that he disposed of himself freely. The bargain concluded, it is discovered that he was no free agent. Footnote. The proceedings, the manoeuvres of capital, for example, from 1848 to 50, have afforded, moreover, incontrovertible proof of the fallacy of the assertion so often advanced, that operatives need no protection, but may be considered as free agents in the disposal of the only property which they possess, the labour of their hands and the sweat of their brows. Free labour, if so it may be termed, even in a free country, requires the strong arm of the law to protect it. To permit, which is tantamount to compelling, to work 14 hours a day with or without meals, etc. End of footnote. The time for which he is free to sell his labour power is the time for which he is forced to sell it, that in fact the vampire will not lose its hold on him so long as there is a muscle, a nerve, a drop of blood to be exploited. Footnote. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. For protection against the serpent of their agonies, the labourers must put their heads together, and, as a class, compel the passing of a law, an all-powerful social barrier, that shall prevent the very workers from selling, by voluntary contract with capital, themselves and their families into slavery and death. Footnote. The 10 Hours Act has, in the branches of industry that come under it, put an end to the premature decrepitude of the former long-hour workers. Capital, in factories, can never be employed in keeping the machinery in motion beyond a limited time without certain injury to the health and morals of the labourers employed, and they are not in a position to protect themselves. End of footnote. In place of the pompous catalogue of the inalienable rights of man, comes the modest Magna Carta of a legally limited working day, which shall make clear when the time which the worker sells is ended, and when his own begins. Quantum mutatus ab illo. What a great change from that time. Virgil. Footnote. A still greater boon is the distinction at last made clear between the worker's own time and his master's. The worker knows now when that which he sells is ended, and when his own begins, and by possessing a sure foreknowledge of this, is enabled to prearrange his own minutes for his own purposes. By making them masters of their own time, the Factory Acts have given them a moral energy which is directing them to the eventual possession of political power. With suppressed irony, and in very well weighed words, the factory inspectors hint that the actual law also frees the capitalist from some of the brutality natural to a man who is a mere embodiment of capital, and that it has given him time for a little culture. Formerly the master had no time for anything but money. The servant had no time for anything but labour.